and the Jewish temple police, along with the Roman soldiers, coming out of the gate toward Gethsemane. And as that occurs, Peter had said, "Lord, I am willing to die with you or die for you." And we start tonight with John chapter 18 and verse 10. John 18 and verse 10. Put the scene in your mind. The soldiers are coming toward this little group in the Garden of Gethsemane. From the standpoint of the size of both groups, it's almost ridiculous. Here comes perhaps as many as 600 soldiers, all armed to the teeth. And here is Jesus, a willing prisoner, who steps forth and says, "I'm not running. Here I am. I'm the one you're coming after." And yet all this force is against him. To Peter's credit, he really was willing to do great things for the Lord, and he was certainly willing to die for him. And that is taken from the standpoint that if you are being approached by several hundred heavily armed soldiers, would you pull out your sword and take on all of them? Peter was willing to do that because in chapter 18 and verse 10, Simon Peter, this is as this group approaches him, "having therefore a sword, drew it, struck the high priest's slave, and cut off his right ear, and the slave's name was Malchus." Two interesting things about what happens right here. The first one is this. This is the last miracle, the last credential that he is the Messiah, because he reaches over, picks up the ear, and puts it back on the head of Malchus. And it's like saying, "All right, one more time, one more miracle I'll put in front of you." The arresting officers are very emphatic in verses 12 and 13. Each one of them has the definite article in Greek, and it's like listing them particularly. So, the Roman cohort, the commander, the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. A couple of significant things here. First of all, it says they bound him. This is the first time in the entire earthly ministry of Jesus that he was not free to move. He had been persecuted. He had been hassled, but for the first time, they put the cuffs on him, so to speak, and he is not able to move. The binding of Jesus in verse 12 is significant for two reasons. The first one comes out of Psalm 118, 27. Psalm 118 and verse 27. In poetic form, the psalmist describes what took place in the Old Testament sacrificial system. And as he tells what takes place, the first step in making an offering is put in poetic form in verse 27 of Psalm 118. "The Lord is God, and he has given us light. Bind the festival sacrifice with cords to the horns of the altar." And whenever there was a sacrifice made, whenever there was a festival, the first thing is tie up the sacrificial animal, and that's what's happening. Now, it's interesting. Then we go back to John 18, another thing. But they arrested Jesus and bound him and led him. And note the verb led. They did not drive. They did not drag him to Annas, as many prisoners were, had to be forced or dragged. He was led. And it's interesting. The same word that is used here for led is used in Isaiah 53:7. Every action that takes place in this section is very significant. He is bound like the Old Testament sacrifice is bound. He was led. And the same verb that is translated led is found in verse 7. "He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth, like a lamb that is led to the slaughter." And so you have a correspondence of what happens at this arrest. He is bound for the first time like a sacrifice. He is led, not dragged, fulfillment of Isaiah 53, verse 7. And he was led to Annas. Who was Annas? Annas had been the unofficial ecclesiastical head of Israel for 20 years. That's not correct. He had been high priest 20 years earlier, and had been succeeded by his five sons. Why would they take him to Annas? Caiaphas was the high priest. Why Annas? Several reasons. Number one, his ecclesiastical power. If you know anything about politics, you know that there are officials that are elected, and then there are political bosses that must be consulted. Like, you just don't do anything or make any move without consulting so-and-so who's been here for 30 years. That's where Annas stood. He had a line of sons in the priesthood, and you just didn't move without consulting Annas. He was first. Second, remember Judas has gone out and he's got a job to do? The high priest would preside over the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin were all in bed. They hadn't been told the night before that this is the night we're going to betray the Lord. They were in bed. They had to be contacted. So Judas is out here pulling all these men together, and we got to buy some time. So the best way to do it would be to go to Annas, which they do. Annas also represented seasoned experience. He was 70 years old by now, and he'd seen things like this before, and it was difficult. How are we going to get this man crucified? How are we going to kill him when we don't have the right of life and death? Consequently, his experience was needed, and then there was always the possibility, what if some of the opinion objects? They won't. Not if Annas says do it. So there's reason for this. Here again is the second illegality of his trial, coming into chapter 18 when he comes to Annas. Verse 13, they led him to Annas first, and that is this. Private preliminary hearings were illegal. You could not privately bring a prisoner before a judge in a private matter for examination. Notice right here, they arrest him and take him immediately to Annas. That was illegal. Same thing for Caiaphas. The other legal point is, like in our system, a prisoner could not be made to incriminate himself. You could not question him in such a way that he would, by answering honestly or questions, would incriminate himself. This was done. So upon the first legal examination, upon the first illegal examination, you have verse 22. And notice how verse 19, the high priest therefore questioned Jesus, that's illegal, about his disciples and about his teaching. That's, where's the charge? There's no charge. No charge has been made. They're trying to get a charge. That's illegal. Jesus answered, and the way he answered is very pointed, as though he's saying, look, this is a nighttime deal and it's illegal. And the way he does that is by, in verse 20, the pronoun I is emphatic, and it implies contrast. Jesus answered him, I have spoken openly in the temple. I always taught in the synagogues. What's that imply? You sneaks. I was open. I was in the synagogue. And you're doing this all by nighttime? Well, with that, verse 22, the tone of that emphatic pronoun is picked up by one of the soldiers. And in verse 22, when he had said this, one of the officers standing by gave Jesus a blow, saying, is this the way you answer the high priest? No charge, nighttime, and he's already been hit without a charge. Everything in the trials of Christ is a mockery in terms of justice is concerned. Third or fourth point, whatever, of legal procedure. Only a witness could initiate charges. The judge couldn't. Can you imagine being brought before a judge? There's no charge. You've been charged with anything. It's done at midnight at the courthouse, and the judge brings you in and starts to ask you questions. The purpose of asking questions is to get you to say something that he can formulate a charge with. Judges don't formulate the charges. Witnesses do. And in this particular context, there were no witnesses. Now, they did make an effort, remember? They went out and they tried to get witnesses that could tell the same story. They had to have two and they couldn't find them. So there's an attempt there, but it's an attempt to gain false witnesses. With this examination before him, he goes, and verse 24 is our transition. Verse 24 of chapter 18. Annas, therefore, sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Now, we need... keep in mind, when you do the New Testament, especially accounts like this, there are three or four scenes going at once. Remember, you've got Judas out there. He's doing his thing, trying to get everything together for that, to get the Sanhedrin together. Phones are ringing. And at the same time, Jesus is in the palace of Annas. He's being questioned. And the palace was a rectangular type thing, and all the rooms looked in on the courtyard, so that it was rectangular, looking into the courtyard. Peter is sitting down in the courtyard, and one of the things that is pointed out here, and all four Gospels do it. All four Gospels deny the four denials of the three denials of Peter. No exception to that. But here's what you want to get. Two scenes. Picture the courtyard. Peter sitting there with the Roman soldiers, warning himself about the fire. The Lord is up in the second floor with Annas. And the sequence of event, it is very, very interesting. In chapter 22 of Luke, and let's go to that, Luke 22. And I hope you've got a mind for putting together a dramatic scene, because it is definitely that. Chapter 22 of Luke, and we'll stay there for a bit, verse 56. Oh, let's go back. Verse 54. Having arrested him, Jesus, they led him away and brought him to the house of the high priest. So he's up in the second story in the quarters of the high priest Annas. But Peter was following in a distance. After they'd kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter was sitting among them. And here's his first denial. A certain servant girl, seeing him as he sat in the firelight, looking intently at him, said, "This man was with you too." But he denied it. I think it's very interesting. The whole cohort of Roman soldiers comes toward Peter. He pulls out his sword and he's willing to fight. He's got guts. Is this a story of many a man? He fell to a little girl. She must have looked a special way, and Peter said, "I can't tell the truth." And it's interesting. Peter failed at his strong point, not his weak point. Peter was very strong and very courageous, and that's exactly where he fell. Good spiritual lesson. That's the easiest place sometimes to fail, is at the strongest point. And Peter did it in this particular context. The first denial was simple. The second was with an oath. And the third was with much swearing and cursing. Now, here's where we need to put the scene together. You got Jesus down the upper level, and picture Peter down here around the fire. Annas is just through with Jesus. And let's picture them. They're starting down the steps on the way over to the house of the high priest or over to the house of Caiaphas. Now, it may have been that in one wing was Annas and in Caiaphas was the other. At any rate, to get from one to the other, you had to pass through the courtyard. So here is Peter sitting there. Jesus is now being led down the steps. And as Peter says for the third time, "I do not know him," the cock sounded, just like the Lord had said. And if that weren't enough to make the scene dramatic, he said three times, "I did it three times," and the alarm goes off. And just as Peter looked up, Jesus was being led across the court, and their eyes meet. And Peter went out and wept bitterly. Let's read that in the text. Verse 60. And notice all the things that happen all at once here to make a dramatic scene. Peter said, "Man, I do not know what you're talking about." And immediately while he was speaking, a cock crowed, just like the Lord had said would happen. And the Lord turned and looked at Peter. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had told him before the cock crows today, you will deny me three times. And as their eyes meet, Peter jumps up and he leaves. And he went out and wept bitterly. Dramatic scene, isn't it? Can you imagine being in Peter's place? The Lord said three times, "I just did it," and cock-a-doodle-doo, or whatever a cock does, it goes, that's what he said. And then he looks up, and there he is looking right at him, and their eyes meet. And that was enough for Peter. He goes out and weeps. Now, with that, there was a problem. And let me read off to you two other illegalities. Before Jesus is delivered to Pilate, and that's we're on the way, between Annas and Caiaphas, there's a little section of mockery. Go to it in Luke 22, verse 63. We're only moving now from the palace of Annas to that of Caiaphas. The men who were holding Jesus in custody were mocking, present tense, over and over, mocking him and beating, present tense, over and over and over again. So as the Lord goes from Annas to Caiaphas, two things: physical assault in the mocking and beating, verbal assault, physical assault, and then they blindfolded him and asked him, prophesy which one of us it is that is hitting you. So his claims to know all things, his claims to be deity are mocked. He is physically beaten. No trial, nothing of that sort. I'm about to sneeze and I can't. Thank you. And so as he comes across the courtyard, one of the notable things in the trials of Jesus, and I think we should take time to look at all of them, is that Jesus was able, in the face of illegal treatment, to keep cool. Didn't say a thing. Silence was a mark. For example, he was silent before Caiaphas, he was silent before Herod, and he was silent before Pilate. Let's go first, since we're right there, to 23:9 of Luke. And notice, in front of Herod, he is silent. He questioned him, he that being Herod, questioned him at some length, and he answered him nothing. Keep your finger in Luke, because we'll be back to it. Matthew 27:12. Before Herod, he is silent. Matthew 27 and verse 12. He is before Pilate, and before Pilate, the Jewish Sanhedrin and Jewish leaders shout taunts at him. And in verse 12, while he was being accused by the chief priests and elders, he made no answer. Matthew 26:63, just back a page. 26:63. The high priest says, you make no answer. Verse 63, but Jesus kept silent. And I think that all spells out control. And it's before Caiaphas, it's before Herod, and it's before Pilate. Now, he's ready at this point to be delivered over to Pilate. Two other illegalities, and these both come out of the Talmud. One, no court could ever convene before the morning sacrifice. At sun up in the morning, there was a sacrifice made. Until a sacrifice made, no legal convening and certainly no legal trial could occur. This happens about 3 in the morning. So we're a good 3 hours before the morning sun. That was illegal. Number two, no proceedings could be conducted on the day before a Sabbath or Passover or any feast day. And this was before it. It's almost as though they said, how illegal can we make this? You almost go through and think that that's got to be a thrust of the whole thing, that this is illegal from beginning to end. And perhaps that is God is saying, is that I don't depend for the legalities of men in order to execute my plan. You can do everything illegal you want. All it can do is farther my plan. That's the sovereignty of God in absolute control. Well, at this point, he now goes over to the Romans. And we can stay, I believe, with Luke with this. He's going to be now turned over to him. Let's use another account. Let's use Mark. Mark 14. I'm just trying to pick up the ones that give a little more details and touches than the other. Mark chapter 14. As we said this morning, the normal residence of Pilate was not Jerusalem. The normal residence of Pilate was Caesarea. He came down to Jerusalem at Passover because he needed to bring down his soldiers, put them in the palace of Antonia, adjacent to the temple, or really in the temple grounds, because there might be an uprising and you needed Roman help to put it down and put it down immediately. But basically, he kept in his palace, as we said this morning. He hated Jews. Jews hated him. And so the feeling was completely mutual. However, the problem that rose was this. Under Roman law, the Jews could pronounce a death sentence, but they couldn't carry it out. In other words, they could say, by our Torah, by our law, you're guilty of death. They could pronounce the sentence, but they couldn't do it. And that isn't what they wanted. So in order to do that, they've got to get Roman permission in order to do so. So they've got a dilemma. The Sanhedrin has said, on the basis of the Old Testament, he's guilty of blasphemy, claiming to be God. Bring it into Roman court and say, Pilate, we're bringing a prisoner here on the charge of calling a man God. Hopefully, Pilate would have had a sense of humor, because the Romans called Nero God. And consequently, if you would say this man calls some man God, called himself God, then what would that be saying about Nero? Nero is guilty of blasphemy, and he ought to be stoned by Rome, by the Jewish method of stoning also. So they couldn't do that. So they did what attorneys will often do in the middle of a trial. Change the charge. That's somewhat illegal. And in the middle of it, they go from the charge of blasphemy, which would be laughed out of a Roman court, and they charge it to sedition. Mark 14:57. Some stood up and began to give false testimony against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with hands, and in 3 days I will be another made without hands. And not even in this respect was their testimony consistent. And the high priest comes forth, and the charges are made, and the charge develops into one of sedition. Now, let's turn to the first legal aspect of his trial. It's found in John 18. It's the first legal thing that was done. And it comes from Pilate. John chapter 18, verse 29. They bring him before Pilate, and Pilate in verse 29 does something that was very legal and required by Roman law. Pilate therefore went out to them and said, what accusation? And that was a technical term for what is the charge? What is the charge that you bring against this man? And they said, sort of like this, oh, we wouldn't want to bother your time with something like a charge. We wouldn't delivered him up to you. We wouldn't have bothered you if he wasn't worthy of death. And Pilate catches on. He knows exactly what they're trying to do. Notice the next verse. Pilate therefore said to them, okay, take him yourselves, judge him according to your law. And then here comes the truth. The Jews said to him, we're not permitted to put anyone to death. And so we've got him here because we want you to pronounce death sentence on him. And at this point, he begins to consider that. Now go once again to Luke 23. Luke 23. Pilate says, I'm trying to get a legal charge here, and you haven't given me any. Pilate wanted out of this thing in the worst sort of way. And consequently, three words triggered the next move in the scenario. And they're found in 23, 5, and 6. They, that is the Jews, keep on insisting, saying, he stirs up people teaching all over Judea, starting from Galilee, even as far as this place. And the three words that caught Pilate's attention were, starting from where? Starting from Galilee. We know a good deal about Galilee. We know that Galilee was a hotbed of Jewish revolution. As a matter of fact, Herod the Great had faced a lot of guerrilla warfare up in that particular area against Rome. And the zealots and the patriots of Galilee were always making life hard for Rome. If you wanted trouble, it's just like, okay, there's trouble in Palestine. You would say, okay, what are they doing in Galilee? And you'd know that there was guerrilla warfare, and there was a good deal of it at that particular time. So Pilate thought, I'd like to get out of this. Roman law has two provisions. One, if you commit a crime, you could be tried in the province in which you committed it. On the other hand, you could say, I don't want to be tried in that. I wanted what we would call a change in venue. And the change in venue would be to the place that you were born. So if you were being tried in a certain area and felt like the emotion was too high, you could do, I want a change of venue. I don't want to be tried where the crime was committed. I want to be moved to where I was born and tried there. Under Roman law, that was legal. And Pilate remembered something. Jesus started up in Galilee. By the way, Herod's in town this weekend. Herod is the boss up there. He's in town. I'll just turn him over to him. So you come down to verse 8. Verse 6. When Pilate heard it, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. And when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself was also in town or in Jerusalem at that time. And the following context describes how Herod responded. Herod was an interesting character. In 4 BC, he was made tetrarch of Galilee and Perea. That's on the other side of the Jordan. He made a visit one day to his half-brother, Herod Philip. And wow, does this guy ever have a gorgeous wife? And so he fell in love or in lust, whatever, with Herodias. And they eloped. As soon as they did so, John the Baptist approached them and said, this is wrong. You have sinned. You've taken your brother's wife. They threw John in jail for saying that. And then along came a birthday. And there was a girl present there that was told, you can have whatever you want. This was Herod's daughter. And she said, I'd like to have John the Baptist's head on a platter. And I can't resist the parenthesis right here. That's vicious, isn't it? You know, I just kill him and dump him. I want his head on a platter. Bring it to me as part of the party. I was listening this week to one of the new tacts of feminism. The cause of all violence in the world is men. They go to war. And if we could only have women in control, we would not have wars because women don't go to war. And they are historically the ones that stay home. The men are the fighters. And as I heard one say, it is really true that war and violence comes from mankind, man emphasizing gender. Well, I don't know that I'd like a world ruled by Herod's daughter, who at her whim, she's a vicious lady. May I say, she's a vicious lady. I want his head on a platter. Well, Bible differs with lots of things that we believe today, but nonetheless, here is violence coming out of and probably one of the most vicious acts in the New Testament, the life of Jesus. Can you think of anything else more vicious than what this girl desires? And of course, she gets it at this party. Herod later heard about some of the miracles Jesus did. And he wanted, for about a year and a half, he wanted to meet him so bad he could feel it. And he was hoping for an occasion. So, coming down to these particular verses, he's taken over to Herod in verse 8. Verse 9, he questions him at some length, answered him nothing. Chief priests and scribes were standing by accusing him. Herod, with his soldiers, after treating with contempt and mocking, dressed him in a gorgeous robe, sent him back to Pilate. And what a strange verse. We sometimes say how wonderful friendship is. Not always. Friendship can be as evil as anything else if it's on the wrong basis. And notice, Herod and Pilate, verse 12, became friends with one another that very day. For before, they'd been at enmity with one another. And so what do? They say, we can join hands. I've hated you all my life, but now you're my friend because we share something mutual. You hate Jesus and I hate Jesus, and we join together. You almost think today that we see that same type of thing, do we not? Is that it's a mutual hatred of the Word of God that causes some people to bind together? I don't like your cause, you don't like my cause, but you know, we found common grounds. We do detest the Word of God, and so we join hands on it. This is what happens in this particular context with these two. The trial ends up, strangest verdict ever. I find the accused absolutely innocent. Take him out and crucify him. No sense or logic, is it? you would think the verdict would follow logically. I find no fault in him. I release him. I find no fault in him. Take him and crucify him. And now let's turn to chapter 15 of Mark, the crucifixion. Mark chapter 15, the crucifixion. And we'll look at that as to Golgotha, at Golgotha, in two sections. Mark chapter 15, verse 21. And they pressed into service a passerby coming from the country. Pressed into service was a legal term for, under Roman law, what a soldier could do. If he was carrying a load on any road, he could press any citizen into service to carry his pack for a mile. That was just simply a law. He'd come up, say, take my pack, take my gear, I want you to carry it a mile. That's where Jesus says, if someone asks you to take it a mile, you do what? Take it too. But that was part of Roman law. And so they pressed into service, a legal Roman procedure, a passerby coming from the country, Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear his cross. And they brought him to the place of Golgotha, which is translated the place of a skull. The path that was taken as a person was led to crucifixion was significant. The normal procedure for leading a prisoner to crucifixion was to lead him through the busy thoroughfares of the city and the busy streets. No shortcuts. You go right down Main Street. You don't bypass the crowds. You go right down Main Street, and being carried by the prisoner or by someone else was the charge. And along with the charge being carried by someone, he also carried the transverse piece of the cross. Vertical, transverse. And the transverse was detached. And it was very heavy. It would be like carrying a railroad tie. Like carrying a railroad tie. And the prisoner had the railroad tie on his shoulders, which is a struggle in itself. Ahead of him was the charge. The reason they ran him through the busy streets, Main Street, was they felt it was therapeutic. It reminds people what happens when you hassle Rome. It was sort of a public type of thing. As we want you to know, and I guess if we could put it in our terms, we think, so they would say, that for you to witness a hanging would be really good for you because it'd make you a law abider. Now, I know we're much more refined than that today, but it would be like saying, okay, you sell dope, you can die for that. And what we want you to do is we want you to be in the room and hear the sizzle of the electric chair. That might have effect on you. There are some cultures that do that, you know. For stealing, you get your hand cut off. And you couldn't heal that. You go around all through your life, I'm a thief, I'm a thief, I'm a thief. It would be sobering. It would keep your fingers out of the till, I would think. At least it would mine. Maybe it wouldn't prevent any others, but I would think it would. And that's been the philosophy of many, many cultures. You exhibit the lawbreaker, and you show his punishment as a therapeutic matter for everybody that views it. And knowing the horror of crucifixion, you can see this poor guy coming down the street. He's carrying his transverse piece. He can barely make it. The charge is in front of him. He was guilty of sedition against Rome. Better be careful. And they felt that that was the way. And that was the rationale. With verse 23, we come to Golgotha. They tried to give him, and now he is there. They tried to give him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. The humane practice of giving some kind of sedation to a prisoner, especially one that was going to be executed, had its roots in two ways. One was in Rome. The other was the Jewish thought found in Proverbs chapter 31. And this reflects Jewish thought of someone who is in utter agony, that some type of sedation was in order. And therefore, in Proverbs 31, verse 6, says, give strong drink to him who is perishing, and wine to him whose life is bitter, let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his trouble no more. So Solomon's advice pertains to that, and it was applied in cases where someone is about to die. You give him sedation. There's a historical record that is interesting, and I'm coming out of Suetonius and Pliny for this. There was a physician named Pedanius, P-E-D-A-N-I-S, who specialized in sedating. He studied, according to the historical record, some 600 plants and 1,000 drugs, and he came to this conclusion. The most effective narcotic is myrrh. So notice going back then to Mark and chapter 15 and verse 23. They took the alcohol or the wine and they mixed it with a myrrh, which at least according to the historical record was a narcotic, but he did not take it. And I think that's significant that he's simply saying, I will feel the pain of the cross, all of it, and he turns that down. In verse 34 of Mark, it says, and notice the economy of words, and they crucified him. Sometimes the force in literature comes across by economy of words. You get in these big, long descriptions, and you lose it. And look at the simple statement, and all the accounts do this. They crucified him, implying that the reader understood what was involved. And let me describe just a little bit of what was involved in the idea of crucifixion. The one comes to the place of crucifixion with the transverse piece being carried by himself. He's then placed on the ground with his arms spread, and the nails are put in for the crucifixion. He's now on the ground. Soldiers then lift the transverse piece up and they attach it to the cross. And then the feet are attached to the cross. In June of 1968, a team of Israeli scholars discovered the Jewish tomb and one who had been crucified, and they describe it, how the feet were almost parallel to one another. I'm using their report. It was transfixed, and the nail went through at the heel point. The legs were adjacent. The knees were doubled in this particular crucifixion victim, meaning the leg was crossed over, so that the right knee was over the left, and the left, in other words, was not simply crucified like this, but it was this type of thing, with the feet parallel together, and then nailed onto the vertical piece. The report, at least archaeologically, that the trunk was almost completely contorted, and so forth, and the upper body on this particular one, and they apparently just took the crossbar and threw this guy in a common grave. And the nails were still there. They were almost 6 inches in length. And they went through feet, through hands, and that is where he died. Now, one other thing, the height of the cross. Since they love to demonstrate justice, the height of the cross was significant. Normally, the description of the cross was about your stature. In other words, there's no need to elevate any person so that the feet didn't go all the way to the ground, but 5-6 inches, no need for anything big, and it was about the height. So you could converse with the person, you could hand the person things and so forth. However, if you wanted high visibility and lots of humiliation, you string up on a very high cross. That probably was true of Jesus. Can you think of one reason why the cross of Jesus was high? Remember when the soldier handed him the sponge with vinegar in it, but he couldn't reach him, and he had to put it on a reed or a stick, and that would very clearly indicate that they wanted high visibility. We want everybody to see what we do to people who are guilty of sedition, and they erected the Lord on an extra high, high cross. Crucifixion, death by it, a lot has been written on it.
It's relative to a lot of things. It'd be relative to a person's condition physically. It would be relative to the variations they could do in crucifixion. They could crucify with the nails very painfully. Or there are even cases where the joint or the arm in which was would be twisted backwards so that you could crucify with the arms almost disjointed, being, I don't know what that would do. What would that do to my arm if you turned all the way over? It would disjoint something, wouldn't it? Probably. I mean, I can't get farther than that. I can't do a push-up. I mean, what's those things? Touch your toes? I've tried that since third grade. Never could figure why you want to touch your toes standing up anyway. It's easier sitting down. But nonetheless, they could be twisted. So you had all kinds of variations. You could put it that way, or you could twist it all around, and sometimes, you know, completely do that. So there are variations that were always there and available with crucifixion. If you wanted a quick death, they'd break the legs. Simply because, have you seen on crosses, there was often a little foot piece. And you can see what would happen with legs broken. Then the entire weight of the body would come down on the upper parts. And you'd literally, by breaking the bones, would hasten death. With Jesus, no bones were broken. That was a matter of prophecy in the Old Testament. And the fact that no bones were broken is John 19:31-36. The soldiers come by, they break the bones of the others, but they see Jesus is already dead, and so they do not do that. What was the cause of Jesus' death? Again, there have been all kinds of writings on it, but basically the cause of Jesus' death is Matthew 27 and verse 50. And that's not to deny the physical aspects of it. Matthew 27:50, you have one of the last cries of the Lord on the cross. Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up, or actually it's active voice in Greek, gave over his spirit. And the words, Father, into your hands I commend my spirit, is the real death of Christ. The word yielded is a word that means to send away. It's a word that was used frequently in Greek for divorce. And therefore, it was not the suffering of the cross physically that put him to death. He yielded up his life in a voluntary way. The real suffering of the cross was not the physical, though it's something that we would grimace at, and it was designed to be as horrible a death as you could ever know. That was the purpose of crucifixion. But the agony of the cross was, my God, why have you forsaken me? The spiritual aspect of it was the real, real difficult. Notice in chapter 15, verse 26, once again, of Mark. Remember, this inscription had been carried to Golgotha by someone else. When the prisoner was crucified, the sign was left there and placed over their head. And so, verse 25, it was the third hour when they crucified him, and the inscription of the charge against him read, the King of the Jews. Now, Paul centers on that, only he says, while the plaque over the cross physically was the King of the Jews, let me tell you what it really was, Colossians 2:14. What is placed physically over the cross, Paul interprets theologically, and he does so in Colossians 2. And verse 14. And we go back to verse 12, having been buried with him in baptism, in which you are raised up with him through faith in the working of God who raised Christ from the dead. And so forth, when you were dead in your transgressions and circumcision of your flesh, he made you alive together with him, having forgiving all your transgressions, having canceled out the certificate of death, consisting of decrees against us, which was hostile to us, and he has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to his cross. So the spiritual aspect of the inscription over the cross is simply says, man's sin And as you look at the cross and the death of Christ, you're reminded that it was His substitutionary work that was placed there and placed over the cross. Lots of ridicule came from the passers-by around the cross. Remember when they said, if you're a Savior, why don't you come on down from the cross and save yourself? That could be a remark taken out of the, or alluding to, the Midrash. In that Jewish writing, you have a quote: before a man puts his trust in another man and asks him to save him, let him save himself from death first. And so the Lord, again, is taunted with this in this particular context. When you look at the chronology of the cross, you have from a couple of things. You have seven things He says on the cross. We're not going to touch them, but just a couple of generalizations. The interesting one is this. The first and the seventh have something unique attached. The first and the seventh both say, Father. The first is, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. The last is, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. The other have no such address. So it's interesting. He begins on the cross in fellowship with his Father. He can call him Father. Nothing is broken. Then as we come toward the middle of the crucifixion, my God, not my Father, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And then he says, it is finished. And after he says it is finished, do you know what he says again? Father. And with that word, tetelestai, it is finished, you have the dramatic emphasis on the accomplishment of the cross on behalf of us. He is taken, he is put in a grave, and early the next morning. By the way, one aspect that's often overlooked at the crucifixion of Jesus, how well do you do without sleep? The Lord woke up, as Jewish custom would be, early on Thursday morning, or one morning. He went through to the next morning and through the next evening until the morning of the next day without sleep. That would be like you're getting up at 6 o'clock Monday, and at Tuesday you're still awake, and you plan to eat the Passover. You do that in the afternoon. And then you're on trial by 1 o'clock the next day. So from Monday through to Tuesday, through to a Wednesday, no sleep. And that would have to be another aspect that is not often mentioned. The Lord had to be exhausted in this particular the crucifixion scene. Then again, 3 days in the tomb. And we have the recording of what I believe is the most unchallenged event of all of human history, which is the resurrection of Christ. There is nothing that can be documented more fully. And I would urge you to look at something like Josh McDowell's Evidence That Demands a Verdict, of all the features that pertain to the resurrection and that verify that this truly occurred on that early first day of the week. Father, we're thankful today for your truth as given to us in the Word of God. And we're thankful for the privilege of taking the time to kind of put together scene to scene to scene and what happened in this last day of the life of Jesus Christ. And we're thankful above all else that what was intended by God to accomplish, the redemption of men, was accomplished effectively by Jesus Christ. And we're thankful, therefore, tonight that we can rest in that work. And in His name we pray. Amen.